loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, negotiators clashed on Sunday over whether to limit the number of migrants whom authorities can detain at the border, creating a new hurdle as the two sides try to strike a compromise before the government shuts down again on Friday. Next, today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill focuses on the teacher strike in Denver. Then, what's a stock buyback? It's a common way for companies to prop up their stock prices and create wealth for shareholders. The company uses cash on hand to buy its own stock on the open market, thus propping up the price regardless of what the economy is doing. But is that necessarily a good thing? Couldn't the money be put to better use if it's spent on innovation or on workers? And then the U.S. and South Korea struck a last-minute deal over the weekend on the cost of the U.S. military presence there. South Korea will pay $890 million a year for the U.S. military to occupy its country, an 8.2% increase over the previous five-year deal. South Korea already was paying 50% of the cost of the U.S. military presence, but the U.S. had sought at least $1 billion per year. And finally, President Trump refused to abide by a legal mandate to tell Congress by Friday, last week, whether the White House thinks Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. A senior administration official said, quote, "The president maintains his discretion to decline to act on congressional committee requests when appropriate," unquote. Before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. 16 civilians were killed today in Syria as they headed for the Iraq border, including 7 children, 8 women, and an elderly man, as the U.S.-led coalition continued their airstrikes on one of the last pockets of insurgents. The coalition was not immediately available for comment, according to the Associated Press. Today is the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, when the people of Iran overthrew the U.S.-backed regime of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, addressed a rally today and denounced U.S. sanctions on the country, saying that they would not break Iran. Estimates of rallies and gatherings across the country range from hundreds of thousands to millions of people, varying across different media. Representative Walter Jones passed away this weekend in Greenville, North Carolina. He was a vocal supporter of the war in Iraq until he regretted his decision so much that he wrote to individual families of those who were killed during their service, asking for forgiveness and making clear his opposition. The congressman wrote more than 12,000 letters to grieving families. He was 76 years old and was first elected to the House in 1995. Senator Amy Klobuchar officially announced over the weekend in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that she is running for president. She joins a field of 5 Democrats already vying for the nomination. Analysts consider Klobuchar to have a more moderate profile than a few of the other candidates who are running, and she's currently the only candidate from the Midwest. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to congressional negotiations over President Trump's border wall. Negotiators clashed on Sunday over whether to limit the number of migrants whom authorities can detain at the border, creating a new hurdle as the two sides try to strike a compromise before the government shuts down yet again on Friday. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Welcome back, Juan Jose.
Thank you, John and Brian.
Juan Jose, I scanned the morning talk shows today, and Senator Richard Shelby, the senior senator from Alabama, very important Republican, was on literally every one of the news networks this morning, and he was sounding very out of character in that he was very moderate in his comments. He believes that the two sides can come together and come to some sort of an agreement by Friday to avert a government shutdown, but he won't talk about specifics. The bottom line is the same as it's always been. The president wants funding for a wall. The Democrats aren't willing to give funding for a wall. And at the same time, the Republicans want the right for ICE to arrest literally every migrant who crosses the border. The Democrats want to give ICE the right to arrest only those migrants who are coming across the border and have a previous criminal record. Is there any wiggle room here, or are these two positions so far apart that an agreement is just not going to be possible by Friday?
Well, I believe that the two sides are posturing and that neither side has a stomach to undergo a second government shutdown so soon after the first one, especially over the issue of immigration. You know, it's encouraging to hear a prominent Democrat like Governor Gavin Newsom and New Mexico's Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham talk about how the border emergency is a manufactured crisis, it's political theater, it's a charade. But, you know, in truth, that's only a half-truth on their part, because the reality is that it's more than political theater, what we have been witnessing since last October at the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, you can't call political theater, you know, children dying after being arrested by Border Patrol agents and forcibly separated from their parents. So, you know, so that's an issue that we need to be a little bit careful with on the side of the Democrats. Now, it goes without saying, or I guess we should say, that the Democrats are feeling incredible people's pressure to not cave in and give everything that President Donald Trump is demanding, namely the $5.7 billion that he's insisting on getting to build a wall. On the other hand, the Republicans know that there is a majority of the American public who realizes that building the wall is a waste of resources and that we have greater social needs that need to be addressed and that could be addressed with those billions that would be wasted in building an unnecessary wall. So the bottom line is, are we going to have an agreement? You know, yesterday I saw the acting chief of staff of the White House participating in one of these TV Sunday programs where he basically said that a way out of this impasse is for the Democrats to give President Donald Trump whatever money they're going to give him as a way to deal with the wall issue. Democrats have said $2 billion. So Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, said, you know, a way out might be we'll take that money and then President Donald Trump will go and find the rest someplace else. So I think that what we're going to end up with is that we will have some kind of deal made as soon as today or tomorrow in order to avert a shutdown as early as next Friday.
Okay, there we have it. Juan Jose Gutierrez is making a prediction. And it's the same prediction that I made. I, too, as all of the people here know, I made the prediction that the last threatened government shutdown would not result in a government shutdown. Thus, I was proved to be wrong. And I was a little bit meek in my new prognostication. But Juan Jose, I agree with you. I think the basis is there. And truthfully, the Democrats a year ago offered Trump $20 billion for the wall in exchange for reinstating the relief that was provided for the Dreamers, the deferred action for childhood arrivals. In other words, the Democrats have no big fixed position against the wall. There's another thing about this that shows its purely political character. Donald Trump is on the way to El Paso today to have a big campaign-style rally. I mean, that's what he's doing. This is about politics. And Beto O'Rourke is going to have a similar countervailing or alternative rally later in the day. Again, people in El Paso are not demanding a wall.
No.
Like the crime rate in El Paso is the lowest in the country or something. Anyway, go ahead, Juan Jose.
Again, you know, that is the political theater, right? I mean, Donald Trump knows that the overwhelming population of the U.S., you know, the adult population, are against building the wall. Nevertheless, he also understands that his hardcore right-wing base, which is about 30% of the electorate, are sold on the idea that we must stop whatever the cost, immigrants from coming to the United States, documented or undocumented. They see that as eroding, you know, the historical power that constituency has had in this country. And so Donald Trump is doing everything he can to hold on to that 30% hardcore base that he has already in his pocket. And then, you know, the challenge for him is going to be, how does he go about confusing another 20% plus so that he can be reelected in 2020? So going to El Paso is part of giving some red meat to that hardcore political base of his. And the Democrats, by virtue of what Beto O'Rourke is doing, you know, after Donald Trump does his own anti-immigrant rally, is trying to somehow get some of that political support that he's going to need when eventually he launches his presidential bid, because he understands that there's growing support for humane immigration policy reform in the United States. And that's what he's going to be betting on and appealing to. So we're going to have a lot more of this going forward as we head into the election in 2020.
I think Juan Jose is correct, Brian. I think that we underestimate Donald Trump's knee-jerk desire to want to please his base. I think he doesn't care what the center believes. And I think that this rally in Texas proves it. I think that that we are going to head toward another government shutdown. Maybe it'll be one of those shutdowns that lasts for a day and the two sides come to an agreement over the weekend. But I think Donald Trump desperately needs to feel that he's saving face. And that's got to be money for a wall.
Yeah, saving face. But that doesn't mean, again, that there won't be some sort of compromise.
Yeah, I think eventually there will be.
Again, though, the people who really suffer when these shutdowns happen is the 800,000 federal workers who don't get paid, hundreds of thousands of private contractors, and a lot of poor people and working class folks who are dependent on these government services.
We're out of time, so we'll leave it there. We were joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. Bill focuses today on the teacher strike in Denver. He joins us from Chicago. Bill is an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers' Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Good to hear your voices.
So the Denver teachers have gone on strike. It happened early this morning, and the administrators announced immediately that schools would remain open and classes would be taught by administrators and substitutes. Some students are crossing the picket line. Others are not. Tell us what you know about Denver.
Well, you know, I know pretty much what you know, and I think it's important. It's an important action to follow because it comes in this large social movement we've been discussing for months, and that is the demand for public education that really serves the public. And teachers, you know, a lot of these things are being presented as labor struggles, which they are. And importantly, these are leading labor struggles, showing labor what's possible when you flex your muscles and combine with community. But it's important to note that there is a social movement rising up in this country against the privatization of the public space, against privatizing public schools. So what's happening in Denver is that they had, this is the first strike in 25 years in Denver, the first teacher strike. And it comes because in 2006, they had an agreement that was based on now what I would call a failed Obama-era education strategy, which was to pay merit to teachers as a way to improve education. If you stop and think about it for 1 minute, it's a social Darwinist experiment to get teachers to do better by holding out a carrot in front of them and saying, the reason you're not working hard and not succeeding is you don't have enough money. So what we'll do is put you in competition. This runs in the face of everything we know about education and what makes education work. That is, every second grade teacher is competing against every other second grade teacher for a little bit of money. And the idea that that's why people went into teaching in the first place is flawed and false. So what we're witnessing is, in Denver, they said, we want to get rid of merit pay. We want instead to have all teachers' compensation improved. We want smaller class size. We want services. And this is, again, a classic of what we're witnessing across the country. In Chicago, we're in the fourth day of a charter school strike, a large charter school strike, the International Charter Schools, Chicago Charter School Network. And what they wanted to do there was to give teachers more compensation by taking away librarians, counselors, nurses, and so on. So the fight really is to imagine a robust public education system that's fully funded, that has all the resources that it needs to do a decent job by all of our children. That's what's under attack. That's what these teachers are fighting back for. I'm really excited about the Denver model, because what they're doing is saying merit pay isn't what makes schools improve. What makes schools improve is respect, small classes, full support services, and an end to the testing madness upon which the merit system was based. So if you could fight the merit system and push it back a bit, you can also take away some of the dagger of standardized testing that is at the heart of so many school systems across the country.
There's something that bothers me about this Denver situation, too. The governor, Jared Polis, is supposed to be progressive Democrat. He's the first openly gay governor in America. The Democratic Party in Colorado had great hopes for him, has great hopes for him. He hasn't really said, in my view, the right things about this strike. He said that, well, it says here in the Denver paper, the state says a walkout will cost about $400,000 a day and would eat up 1-2% of the district's annual operating budget in a week. In encouraging both sides to come to an agreement, Governor Jared Polis has pointed out that this money will no longer be available to help pay teachers once it is spent on a strike. Well, that's not very encouraging. And it turns out also that Colorado has a state law allowing the governor to intervene in a teacher strike and to order that it be suspended for 180 days. He hasn't said that he'll do that, but he also hasn't said that he wouldn't do that. All he has said so far is that the two sides are not that far apart, and so at this point, he's not electing to involve himself.
Well, that's a cowardly position, and it's a position that's ducking his responsibility. The reality is we've seen cowardly positions by politicians again and again. And when we look at the national scene, what we're seeing is, for example, Cory Booker, who was a major champion of charter schools and other kind of backwards school improvement ideas, trying to run for cover, run away from that because the public mood is shifting. But in Colorado, the governor not only has the right, he has the responsibility to step in on the side of public education. And this is what we keep talking about on your show and what we have to keep talking about, because the larger issue and the thing we have to keep coming back to is, if education is a human right, then we have to spend generously on education. And we can't scrimp and we can't pretend that the nurses and the counselors are to be held against the classroom teachers. No, it's a large system. It's a large responsibility to educate kids. So there are two themes we should be coming back to, and people should press the governor of Colorado to get involved. The two themes are, education is a human right, not a product. And the second theme is, whatever the most privileged people have for their children should be the baseline for what we want for all children. Anything less than that, it destroys democracy. So I think this is, again, something that's ginning up across the country. And we saw it starting in West Virginia. I take the starting, actually, Chicago 5 years ago. But it's sweeping the country. And the important thing is that the underlying issue is, are we going to defend public education against all of its attackers, all of its detractors? Are we going to say every kid in this country deserves a decent, fully funded, forward-looking classroom within reach? And if we believe that, yes, we need more revenue, but we also need a smarter way of thinking about what an educated person is, and we have to get away from the trap of standardized testing as the sole metric of what makes a decent education. No privileged person judges their child solely by a standardized test. We shouldn't judge anybody by that. Kids are more than a score.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We talk to Bill every Monday in this segment called Education for Liberation. I was looking at a Wall Street Journal piece on Saturday and tabulated the number of people who were on strike in the United States last year in 2018. And you had to go all the way back to 1987 to find the same level of workers on strike, as happened in 2018. So we had to go back to 1987 for there to be as many workers on strike in any particular year as there were then. And these are teacher strikes. And that shows us, or it certainly suggested to me, Bill Ayers, these statistics. The teachers are striking, that it's a movement, a social justice movement. It's not simply about pay, although pay is an issue of justice as well. But it also has the impact, and we've mentioned this before, of reviving the labor movement and of reviving the idea of the strike as the weapon of labor. In other words, the withholding of your labor as a way to win justice, something that seemed to be passé or old school coming back now.
Yeah, I think that the kind of triumph of libertarian thinking coming out of Silicon Valley and the idea that each of us is simply an entrepreneur resting on our own bottom is nonsense. And I think what has been encouraging about the teachers and the militancy of the teachers is two things. One is it is a revival of labor as a force, and it's labor led by women. And I think that's important. It's not in every case that the union leader is a woman, but it's a woman's movement. And this is true of the nurses also, who have led some of the most progressive labor actions in the last 5 or 10 years. This is new in the history of labor, and it's something that should be very encouraging to us. So that's part of it. Part of it is that labor, you know, revivified is making a difference. And standing up to the kind of waking up and standing up to the bullying tactics of not only the political class, but of the ruling class, of the capitalist class. And I think people fighting back against that and showing others that it can be done is critically important. That's huge. The other part of it is, if you look at teachers and nurses combined, their labor actions are in concert with community needs. So these are people who are fighting, and this is true, incidentally, of the domestic workers movement as well. These are people who are in professions whose focus is to help others, whose focus is a humanitarian mission. And linking arms with their so-called clients or with the people they serve, being in solidarity with them, it gives them a remarkable strength. And I think people all over the country are seeing it, are understanding it, and it gives me a lot of hope, both for a revived labor movement and an educational movement that demands real social justice.
John Kiriakou, when we introduced Bill Ayers, we mentioned that he has a new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. But Bill Ayers has a lot of books. Bill Ayers is a prolific author. I'm looking, Bill, I just Googled books by Bill Ayers, and it's really impressive. Fugitive Days, Bill Ayers, On the Side of the Child, Teaching the Taboo, An Empty Seat in the Class. Maybe that's your brother, Rick Ayers.
My brother wrote An Empty Seat in Class, but I'll tell you another book that I think is really important. It's true, I've written a lot of books. The interesting thing is I published my first book when I was 45 years old. So I did a lot before that, and then I had a lot to draw on. So I do write all the time, and I have a book coming out in the spring, which I'll tell you about later. But I want to draw your attention to just one other book, which I wrote the foreword to it. It's a book called Being Bad, My Baby Brother and the School-to-Prison Pipeline. And it's by Crystal Laura, who you've had on the show. But I bring it up because there's a new play in Chicago at Victory Gardens Theater called Pipeline, very much based on the ideas that Crystal illuminates so brilliantly. And that is that we have in this country schools whose not explicit but implicit purpose is to channel kids from crummy schools and broken down classrooms into prisons. And the only kind of entitlement left, if there's no mental health, there's no health services, there's no counseling, the only entitlement left is jail for kids. And this is a damn shame.
Yeah, that book is called Being Bad, My Baby Brother and the School-to-Prison Pipeline.
We're out of time, unfortunately. That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joined us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education, in addition to a lot of other books. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
What is a stock buyback? It's a common way for companies to prop up their stock prices and create wealth for shareholders. The company uses cash on hand to buy its own stock on the open market, thus propping up the price regardless of what the economy happens to be doing. But is that necessarily a good thing? Couldn't the money be put to better use if it's spent on innovation or on workers? We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Welcome, Jack.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Jack, yesterday, Senators Chuck Schumer and Bernie Sanders sponsored a bill that would allow stock buybacks only by companies that pay their workers a $15 minimum wage. Tell us why stock buybacks are as common as they are. Are they good? Are they bad? And is this a good idea that Schumer and Sanders have?
Well, it's interesting that Schumer and Sanders finally discover the massive shift of income and wealth that's been going on now since 2010 in the form of these buybacks and dividend payouts by corporations to the shareholders. You know, this year, the estimate is for 2018 that there will be about $940 billion in share buybacks just by the Fortune 500 companies. And there's thousands, of course, of companies. So just the biggest 500 will pay out $940 billion and another $450 billion in dividend payouts. That's $1.3 trillion that they're shuffling off to their shareholders. And most of the shareholders are big shareholders and the management of the companies, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This compares to 2017 of about $900 billion in share buybacks and about $420 billion in dividends, so about $1.3 trillion last year, almost $1.4 trillion this year. And you know, it's been almost $1 trillion, in some cases more, since 2011. So we're looking at already about 8 years of $1 trillion a year on average rising of payouts in stock buybacks and dividends to shareholders. Massive, massive. Now, that's what's causing the income inequality. It's not simply, although it's partly the fact that wages haven't been rising, but it's this massive shift of income to the high end. Now, what's that caused by? The significant profit boom that's been going on since 2011, first of all, and the acceleration in 2017 by about $300 billion more a year in each of 17 and 2018 is attributable largely, especially in 2018, to the Trump tax cuts. In other words, the tax cuts provided a 22% boost to the bottom line of the Fortune 500 companies. Fortune 500 profits were up 27% in 2018. 22% of that was due to the Trump tax cuts. And that include bringing money, repatriated money from offshore, which were part of the tax cuts that were supposed to produce jobs and invest in the U.S. But this money is all going into buybacks and dividend payouts and also merger and acquisition activity, buying up their competitors. It's not going into boosting the U.S. economy. Very, very little is going in that direction. Now, you got to remember, too, that it's not just this massive profits boost and the Trump on top of it that's producing all this excess cash that's going into buybacks and dividend payouts. It's also, in addition to that, interest rates have been so low for so long that, especially before 2018, corporations have been issuing corporate bonds. In other words, raising more cash by selling their bonds, even though they're flush with profits, they're selling their bonds to gather more cash that they're using for buybacks and dividend payouts. And the result of that, and this speaks to your question, is it bad? The result of that is you've got the biggest overflow, you might say, of zombie corporations that are up to their neck in debt because of all this issuing of bonds to finance buybacks. They're up to their neck in debt. And when the next recession comes, which is around the corner, they're not going to be able to pay the principal and interest on that debt, and they're going to default. So it's really a risky thing. We've got trillions of dollars in junk bond debt, high yield, high cost debt, and even half, $4 trillion of the $9 trillion investment-grade corporate bond market is junk, or what they call triple B. So we have somewhere between probably around $5 trillion of junk debt out there that a lot of those corporations aren't going to be able to roll over when the next recession comes. And we're going to see a lot of defaults in the non-financial corporate sector in the U.S. But they're feasting, they're dancing on the deck of the Titanic here while getting all this buybacks and all these share purchases, which, by the way, drive up the price. You know, when you're giving that much money back.
Oh, sure.
It drives up the price of the stock. That's how this stock boom under Trump has been running so hot and so fast. But even the stock boom can't be maintained with stock buybacks anymore. We saw that last fall. And before that, in February of last year, this big stock market correction. And we're going to see an even bigger one here this year. In other words, what they're doing is they're subsidizing with buybacks and dividend payouts. They're subsidizing corporations and investors, they meaning the politicians, especially Republicans and Trump. They're subsidizing this whole game, keeping it going artificially. And the bottom's going to fall out at some point.
Let me ask you then, let's take just as an example a company like Amazon that has an untold amount of cash on hand and is notorious for underpaying its workers. If a company has billions and billions of dollars in cash, what's the best way to spend that money? What's the best way for the company and for the workers?
Well, you gotta say what's the best way for whom, right?
Right.
Of course, for workers in the U.S. economy, it would be to increase their wages so that we could increase consumption and have a consumption-driven economic growth and recovery. We haven't had a consumption-driven, except for the wealthy 10% that own stock, driven economy since 2007 and before. It's all been the wealthy households and businesses and investors. So, you know, paying out and requiring companies to pay out 15, you know, minimum wage. But the problem is these companies that are, and this is my criticism of the Schumer-Sanders thing, it's really a public relations thing in many ways, because the companies that are doing the big buybacks are already paying $15 an hour, you see?
Right.
You know, maybe Amazon's on the cusp there because, a lot of people in their warehouses aren't really making that much. But let's take Apple as an example. Sitting on $250 billion in cash, has been issuing corporate bonds that, because of the low rates provided by the Federal Reserve, and using that money to buy back stock and drive up the price of their stock while they sit on their $250 billion cash hoard, right? You know, Apple is paying more than $15 an hour, at least in the U.S., of course, not in China, where they make most of these iPhones. But that $15 is not going to force them to pay some of the buybacks to their workers. If Schumer and Sanders were really committed to this thing, they would find another instrument other than the $15 minimum wage, or living wage, I should say, as the means by which to ensure some distribution of these vast wealth and riches being created to the workforce. That would be a positive for the economy, because when you give the buybacks to investors, what do they do with it? They're not investing it in the U.S. economy. They're investing it in financial markets in the U.S. and around the world. A lot of the money flows out to emerging markets and to other financial asset markets, stock markets, bond markets, foreign exchange markets, derivative markets. You know, that's why this massive handout that's been going on for 8 years now has not produced a corresponding significant growth in the U.S. economy. You know, we're just barely chugging along here. We should have a 4 and 5% GDP growth rate with all that money if it was distributed in part, at least, to workers. So who does it benefit? It's benefiting the shareholders and investment bankers and all the other wealthy folks in this country, but it's not benefiting the rest.
Jack, we only have 30 seconds left. What do you think the chances are of the Congress acting on such a measure, the kind of measure that Schumer and Sanders are proposing?
Absolutely zero. Because, you know, this is the Republicans who are the handmaidens of the wealthy and corporations and investors aren't even going to consider it. Right. You may get something passed in the House. They will know, however, it will never be implemented in the Senate. And if it weren't implemented in the Senate, Trump, one of the big beneficiaries of all this, would veto it. So it's a campaign marketing ploy here. And, you know, I'm not totally opposed to what Sanders and Schumer have done here. It at least raises the recognition of what's going on. And, you know, this $1.3 trillion, again, is just the Fortune 500. How much of it is really, if you include all the rest out there, corporations out there?
It would be utterly life-changing in the world of business and economics. Unfortunately, we're out of time, though. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. He talks a lot about these issues, so check out the website. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. and South Korea struck a last-minute deal over the weekend on the cost of the U.S. military presence there. South Korea will pay $890 million a year for the U.S. military to occupy its country, an 8.2% increase over the previous five-year deal. South Korea already was paying 50% of the cost of the U.S. military presence, but the U.S. had sought at least $1 billion per year. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Professor Beal, welcome back.
Good to be back.
What is this, like inflationary occupation?
You know, why not just go for it and ask them to pay for everything, right? I mean, that seems to be what the policy is.
And of course, I don't think the people in South Korea get to vote on this, do they, Tim?
No, not as far as I know. No, it's government to government sort of business. It's obviously very unpopular. I mean, you can pick that up from the media, of course, from right-wing press to the liberal press. They don't like being screwed, but that's what's happening. Yeah, the people don't get a chance to say much about it.
You know, I just want to ask you about this, because obviously if a country is living under foreign occupation, and that's what it is, and even now as South Korea wants to improve its relations with North Korea, Moon Jae-in obviously wanted to have some sort of detente, rapprochement, new deal with North Korea. They're always looking over their shoulder to see, well, what does Washington think? Or what does Washington say? I mean, this is the condition one finds oneself in when you're living under occupation. But the occupation of South Korea is not like the Nazi occupation of Greece or Serbia, in the sense that, you know, people were involved in an armed struggle to evict the invaders, and the invaders didn't give a damn about public opinion because they were just ruling by force of arms, period, end of sentence, right? In the case of South Korea, the United States has, over a long time, both used repression, which it has, along with and partnering with the South Korean military, but it's also employed what might be called soft power to make America look like a good power, something that South Koreans would like having a partnership with, et cetera, et cetera. When Donald Trump takes this, you know, out front, egregious policy, we're going to make you pay more for the occupation of your country by our troops, doesn't it change the sort of, not maybe the hard power equation, but the soft power equation in terms of public opinion in South Korea?
Yeah, absolutely. This is, of course, is why the mainstream press and the bureaucrats behind them in the United States are very unhappy about it, because it's unnecessary. It's just, you know, it's just money, a little bit of money, but it has a lot of political fallout. They're very unhappy about it, but again, you know, Trump is president, and they say that he thinks this is going to be to his advantage in the 2020 elections. We don't know.
Professor Tim Beal, what do the North Koreans say about this? Do they necessarily care, or do they see this as just a part of this long-term relationship the United States has with South Korea?
Well, I think they're probably quite, in a sense, quite pleased, because it shows up again in South Korea's sort of colonial status, that it's, you know, paying this tribute to the imperial power every year. So from their point of view, it's in a sense, is to the good. And I think we must remember this is, in a sense, not really so much about North Korea as about China. I mean, the American troops are in South Korea and Japan and what have you, basically because of China. The South Koreans, the Japanese, are paying for the privilege of being on the front line.
That's the voice of Professor Tim Beal. He's talking to us from New Zealand. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. John, I think Professor Beal is making an important point, because even though North and South Korean governments are talking to each other, they're trying to have a rapprochement, there's all kinds of economic and political links going on, there has been a longstanding issue of which government really is the legitimate government in Korea. I mean, this was the basis of the division of Korea after World War II in 1945, and then, of course, with the Korean War in 50 to 53. I mean, there are no foreign troops in North Korea. There haven't been any foreign troops in North Korea since the Chinese left after the Korean War. The Soviets had left as they had agreed to in 1948, 3 years after the partition of the peninsula, into a north and south. Now you have the North Koreans being able to sort of say, well, look, we don't have foreign occupying troops, and we're not paying for foreign occupying troops to occupy Korea. It does match with the issue of legitimacy. We Koreans in the North represent, whatever you think of us, this, that, or the other thing, we represent the longstanding aspiration of the Korean people who have suffered under the yoke of colonialism, first the Japanese and then the new colonialism, the desire to be free of colonialism. Again, it's kind of a gift from Donald Trump. He's running for president. He wants to say, see, we got another pound of flesh out of them. But it's like a gift to the political opponents of U.S. domination in the Korean Peninsula. Tim Beal, go ahead.
You're absolutely right. And of course, it's not merely Korea. I mean, it's, in a sense, it's across the empire. And because you don't actually need occupation for the Americans to do this. I mean, in New Zealand, you wouldn't have heard of this because just concerns New Zealand, but the government here has committed to spending a huge amount of money, $2 billion or something, and it's a lot of money in New Zealand terms, to buy an anti-submarine aircraft. We've got no use for that, of course, but the United States military has. So it's a sort of direct subsidy to the United States. And this happens, of course, around the world. We're focusing on Korea, but that's just one and a very important example of this whole imperial process.
That's Professor Tim Beal. Tim, let's switch topics a little bit again about Korea, but a different issue. February 27th, 28th, the next summit, the number two, follow up to the Singapore summit from June 12th, 2018. What do you expect to happen?
Not very much, I think. Trump obviously wants to pull something off. He can't really do it because his officials, bureaucracy, the military and what have you, are holding him back to a large extent. He doesn't really understand, as far as one can see, what the whole business is about. He has this vision of the North Korea sort of unilaterally disarming, and I can't see that happening. So I think we're going to get some words. But beyond that, not very much. And I think that's basically the game plan of the American establishment. They just want the status quo because they can't really think of any better way to serve their purposes. So beyond the words, we will get, in a sense, business as usual.
The status quo meaning?
Well, the status quo meaning this tension in East Asia, the occupation of South Korea, forces in Japan, primarily in Okinawa, and the whole forward position of the American military in Asia. So again, aimed at primarily at China, to a certain extent at Russia, and you know that's what they want, because the real objective again is military domination on their western frontier in East Asia against China and Russia. So that depends on a continued tension, and the last thing they want is for peace to break out.
Is this a precedent now that's been set whereby the U.S. is going to seek more money from Japan, from Australia, from Thailand, or any other country that hosts U.S. troops in the region?
Oh, yeah. And NATO, of course. I mean, that's the other big one. There's Japan, yes. But NATO, I think, as we know, Trump has been saying for a long time that they're going to have to pay more. And again, you see, NATO is a bit like Korea in that the Americans came in the 40s, American military, and haven't left. I mean, still American bases in Germany. What have we got, 70 years after the end of the war? And NATO continues despite the collapse of the Soviet Union and so forth. So it is a continuing process, and I think Trump does want to increase the extraction of tribute from NATO, as he does elsewhere around the world.
It feels like organized crime, doesn't it, John, where the mafia goes around a neighborhood and tells all the store owners, by the way, you used to have to pay us $50 a month, now it's going to be $55, and like, you don't want to go along? And everybody starts to go along. I mean, doesn't it feel like that?
It really does. It's protection money. It's a protection racket. And you have to pay the VIG every week, or else something terrible could happen.
That's it. We're going to keep following the Korea story. Of course, the issue of the payment by South Korea to the United States is one facet. We're going to pay a lot of attention in the coming weeks to the upcoming summit. Professor Beal doesn't expect much. On the other hand, maybe the change of orientation will create a change inside the Korean Peninsula between the two Koreas. Tim Beal, 15 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be one of the big outcomes, is going to be increased aspirations in South Korea for increased détente and movement towards rapprochement, moving towards Korean unification in the future, and the removal of foreign forces. So that's going to be one big consequence. The other, of course, will be the effect in China. So, yeah, even though not going to be much movement from the American side, there will be consequences.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. President Trump refused to abide by a legal mandate to tell Congress by Friday whether the White House thinks Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. A senior administration official said, quote, "The president maintains his discretion to decline to act on congressional committee requests when appropriate," unquote. We're joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Welcome back, Ariel.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Ariel, this was not just a congressional committee request. This was a law. The president is mandated to respond to this question. And the question is, was Mohammed bin Salman responsible for killing Jamal Khashoggi? There's no accountability here, at least not on the part of the White House. So what next?
Well, if you saw it, Saudi Arabia actually tweeted out last week, basically a statement saying, we're done and this will go no further, and no one will attack our leadership, Mohammed bin Salman. So, you know, this is no surprise. And I think we heard Trump say what he really meant in the very beginning after Khashoggi disappeared, when Trump said, you know, the Saudis are our friends because they buy our weapons. And, you know, then he had to kind of appease people a little bit along the way. And now he's landed right back where he started and just refuses to do anything. This is an issue that just refuses to go away. And the reason it refuses to go away is there is no accountability. A man, a journalist from the Washington Post, was brutally, brutally murdered and then chopped up, and nothing, nothing.
Literally nothing. There's a piece that ran today at AFP, Agence France-Presse. I want to read a couple of passages from it. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Monday denied that Washington was, quote, covering up, unquote, the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and promised further action. Quote, America is not covering up for murder, unquote, Pompeo told reporters in Budapest when asked about criticism by a senior Democrat. The remarks came after U.S. President Donald Trump missed a deadline set by Congress to reply by Friday on whether Saudi Arabia's powerful Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing of the Washington Post contributor. Pompeo said that Trump's administration was, quote, working diligently on its investigation. The president, he said, has been very clear, couldn't be more clear. As we get additional information, we will continue to hold all of those responsible accountable. But Trump has openly said that he does not care if Prince Mohammed was responsible for the killing, as Saudi Arabia buys weapons from the United States and shares his hard line on Iran. There doesn't seem to be any middle ground here. This is the president giving the middle finger to literally everybody else, whether it's the Washington Post, whether it's the American people, because my God, if the Saudis are able to just execute and then chop up a journalist for the Washington Post, what about an American like you or me? We're nobody. Is this president going to walk away from us as American citizens? That's the conclusion I would have to come to. What do you think?
Well, I think that's not surprising for us. And we're also looking at a president who, during his State of the Union speech, basically threatened Congress and said, you know, if you continue this investigation, if I'm under investigation, that we'll get nothing done, no legislation. Come on. So we shouldn't be surprised here. But I think we have to look as well that the U.S. is continuously providing protection for Saudi Arabia, the really largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world, and yet, on the other hand, is attacking Iran and continuing to threaten war and imposing sanctions that harm the people. So this is a really backward situation, and it's one that we shouldn't be surprised. And the other thing that we shouldn't be surprised about is there is no question about whether Mohammed bin Salman was involved in the murder of Khashoggi. We know that he was. Nothing happens in Saudi Arabia without his approval.
You're absolutely right. There was also an explosive piece in the New York Times at the end of last week written by Mark Mazzetti. And Mark is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's a very serious journalist. He knows the Middle East very well. He said last week that Mohammed bin Salman told a top aide in a conversation in 2017 that he would use, quote, a bullet, unquote, on Jamal Khashoggi if he did not return to the kingdom and end his criticism of the Saudi government. And that's according to current and former American and foreign officials with direct knowledge of intelligence reports. That's a leak from the CIA. That's probably also a leak from the Turkish National Intelligence Organization, the TINIO. This information was leaked on purpose, and the reason it was leaked was to put pressure on the president to come clean and to tell the American people what he knows. That obviously hasn't happened. And I'm wondering if there's any recourse. Now, one Capitol Hill staff member said that the House of Representatives had received a letter from Pompeo outlining in bullet points the measures taken by the American government to punish Saudi Arabia for this murder. So what are those measures? 12 Saudis had their visas revoked, and 17 Saudis were told not to apply for a visa. That's what they get for murdering a Washington Post journalist.
Right, exactly. That no accountability. And these are ordinary Saudis, whereas we know who is responsible for the murder, and that's MBS himself, and that's who needs to be held accountable. So I want to point out, while, you know, it's horrific that we're getting no accountability for Jamal Khashoggi, we did have a vote today in the House Committee on Foreign Policy to move forward legislation to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. So while in some places this is very disheartening, on the other hand, we are moving forward to end the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, or to transform it. And that has to be done by the people, and it has to be done by Congress.
Let's talk about that broader issue. There's a new House of Representatives now. It's run by the Democrats, and there are a lot of new Democrats serving their first terms. It seems, at least the early indications are, that the Democrats are willing to go after the Saudis vis-a-vis their war in Yemen, not just the Saudis, but the Emiratis and the Bahrainis as well. It also seems that the Democrats are willing to discuss a real implementation of the War Powers Act. Ro Khanna, who's a freshman representative, has taken the lead on this thing, as has Tulsi Gabbard, and unfortunately the late Walter Jones, who just passed away yesterday. Do you think that we're going to see anything different in terms of congressional oversight or pressure to get the United States out of Yemen, or for the United States to pressure the Saudis to get out of Yemen? Will there be any changes there?
Well, before the end of the last Congress, we saw the War Powers Act go through the Senate, but then it was stopped by Republicans in the House who blocked it. But now we have Democratic control of the House, and so we're watching the bills have been reintroduced. And I think we have every reason to believe we're going to get it through this time. And that is a really big success. We've been working on this for years, and certainly the people of Yemen can't wait. So this is really good news, and we have a lot more to do, because after this bill, what we really need to do is pass legislation to halt weapons sales to the Saudis.
Can you see that happening, at least in the House of Representatives? I would assume that the Republicans in the Senate wouldn't allow it to happen, and certainly the president would veto a measure that passed both houses. But do you think that there's any real pressure that's going to come to bear on the Saudis, whether it's threatening weapon sales or some other measure?
We've seen enormous progress on this, and I think we're still in the early stages, but I do think our hard work is paying off. And I don't think that this is a time for us to rest on this issue. I think we have to keep pushing it forward. We have to keep highlighting what's happening in Saudi Arabia, from the murder of journalists to the war on Yemen to the imprisonment of women activists.
Yeah. Well, how can people get involved with organizations like Code Pink to help keep up the pressure on Capitol Hill?
Well, you can go to our website and you can send a message to your senators and your representative telling them to support the War Powers Resolution. And that is codepink.org/warpowers. And while you're there, then you can also check out the Saudi section of our website and see what else you can get involved in supporting.
Excellent. And there's a lot to talk about relative to Saudi Arabia. There's a lot to talk about relative to Yemen. We were very happy to be joined by Ariel Gold. She's in Washington. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.